The chambers are then.
That is a wonderful place to be because you can
Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, February 16th will come to order. I just bought some Girl Scout cookies from Senator Osmick, so if you guys want to have some, go ahead. And we're going to change the order of the agenda just to get the Bureau of Mediation Services up to the table quickly. And I don't think they'll take real long, and I do believe that maybe the DNR will be here for the rest of the time after that. So we'll take these guys first, so if they want to leave, they can. So come on up, Josh. And state your name for the record, Commissioner, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Josh Tilson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. Thanks for having me here this morning. Last year, we just finished our 75th anniversary. We're, as an agency of the state of Minnesota, we've been serving Minnesota's public employers and public employees since 1979. And we're very proud of the work we do. I gave you a little handout that's in front of you, sort of a little graphic handout that looks familiar with similar to the one we had last year. Our base budget for 2015 is 2.2. All of the money we have comes out of the general fund thus far. Our labor mediation and representation budget is most of the money. It's $1.7 million. Our Office of Collaboration Dispute Resolution, which was created in Iraq, has been around actually since about the 1990s, but it was defunded during the last decade, and it was revived in 2013, is $96,000. We have the new Public Employment Relations Board, which I have some board members here to talk to you about that. If anybody has any questions about the PERB, you will note that there is a $200,000 increase proposed in the budget governor's change items for the PERB board. The money that was put in the budget when the PERB was created was really intended for startup funds to make rules and set up their office. They're not going to be able to operate on the amount of money that's in their budget for 2015. They need to hire staff, and they haven't done any of that yet. We have $228,000 of grants, and our technology budget has grown to $86,000 a year. We are a small agency. We have, oversee mediation, arbitration, representation matters. Last year we did 954 mediations. We had 13 collaborative interest-based facilitation cases. We did 233 representation cases, 62 elections, 379 arbitrations were filed with the Bureau. Of those, we had 55 grievance arbitration awards and about 20 interest arbitration awards. We have 22 new labor management committees and 12 labor relations skills trainings. We think that our performance has been pretty good this last year. We've had a lot of new things to take on, primarily the new PERB and our Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution. We're very proud of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution, and if you'll give me about 90 seconds, I want to talk a little bit about that because it's one of the things we're most proud about.
Don't be in too big a hurry. Make sure you explain yourself, okay? Because otherwise we might have lots of questions.
All right.
Okay.
All right. The So I want to talk about the Office of Collaboration Dispute Resolution, which was funded in 2013. We had an Office of Collaboration that was in place until 2003, and the funding was cut in 2003. And some of the things we've worked on in the 2 years since this, we received a little funding to restart this office, were probably thing we're most proud of, or the thing that you've read about the most, is the child custody, a physical child custody issue, which has been we've been helping to mediate for the last 18 months or so. And last year, House File 2722 was passed, clarifying that there's no presumption of for or against physical custody except when there's a case of domestic abuse. In 2015, the group, which includes four legislators, has introduced several more consensus bills on custody and child support aimed at reducing conflict and improving outcomes for children and families. So that's sort of the signal thing we've done. But we've also been assisting the League of Minnesota Cities and their insurance trust to resolve city conflicts without litigation. We've allocated $320,000 in grants to nonprofit dispute resolution centers, community mediation throughout the state. We provided an analysis of the conflict between MinSCU and the faculty unions and the administration, and we're working to try to get them to work out their disputes, their internal disputes that they've got between the unions and the administration office. We provided mediation services for a number of state agencies, including the Vocational Rehab Services and the Department of Education. We provided training to a number of legislators. I think perhaps some of you were there on our convening and dispute resolution services. and we've set up a new public education service. So we're kind of proud of that. We did all that with a very small amount of money, and we're excited about it. The governor has three change items, which I won't delve into unless you have questions about them. But that's kind of my...
Tell us what they are.
Okay. All right. You want me to walk through them? I will. The first one, the three change items that are on our sheet are, first, the page, it's on page 7. It's the BMS, it's on page 5. It's the BMS case management database. 2 years ago, we were allocated $100,000 for a case management system. It was not enough money. What can I tell you? IT stuff is very expensive. We did the analysis and got started on it and essentially ran out of funds. We're going to have phase one finished by the end of fiscal 2015. The governor's budget has requested $250,000 one time to complete our case management system. This case management system essentially tracks all of our mediation, arbitration, and other dispute resolution work. And we're also planning to add a web interface where clients can go on the internet and file their cases directly over the internet rather than having to send in paper forms or emails, which is what they're doing now. And it has an additional $100,000 added to the base in 2017 to support the licensing and upkeep of that system. So that's that was pretty much our first priority as far as the governor's budget requests are concerned.
Will this amount complete the process?
Yes. Yes.
For sure?
Minute tells me it will. You know what it is with this IT stuff is you have to hire the best people you can and point them in the right direction and tell them what you need, and they tell me that it will be sufficient. And I actually managed a project that created our current database back in the 1990s, and it came in within budget, but it was only one budget cycle. This is a two-budget cycle thing. It's a much bigger project, and they've told me it'll come in within the allotted money that we've asked for. The second thing in our budget request is $59,000 for the family child care representation election. You gave us $59,000 of one-time money last time to do two elections, one for home care providers and one for child care providers. We did one election, which cost more than $59,000 to get accomplished because of the size of the election was much larger than we expected, and we ran out of funds. In fact, I had to dip into our general fund money to complete that. And this money will only be spent if there is a petition for representation among the child care providers in Minnesota. Then we have a biennial budget request for one. Let me make sure I got all this here. There's the PERB request. I'm going to let the PERB talk to you about the PERB request. I mentioned it. Essentially, the PERB got $125,000 in startup money. That startup money is not going to be sufficient for them to start operating. The way the law was established was they were created in FY 14, and they FY 15, excuse me, and they're to start doing business July 1st of FY 16. And this money that was allocated in FY 15 to the base is not enough for them to continue and actually hire a staff. It was pretty much enough money to make rules and start. This is a startup. They have to hire staff. They have to get an office. They have to get computers. It's a new small board to adjudicate claims of unfair labor practices under the statute. So it's a requirement. And then finally, there's a request for about $70,000, $76,000, general inflation adjustments for the BMS's inflationary operating expenses. And that's pretty much our requests.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Yes,
last week, I believe you were in. We visited for a while. The performance measures, I got a couple, maybe one or two questions there.
Yep.
When you talk 0% strikes cost slash strike average, $4 million, can you explain that a little bit to me?
That from the federal. That's what the federal, those are statistics from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Department of Labor, so what the average national cost of a strike is. We haven't had any major strikes in Minnesota since the last major strike we had in Minnesota was in Crosby Ironton in 2005-06, and I venture to guess it cost more than that. I mean, those teachers in Crosby Arrington went on strike for 2 or 3 months in the middle of the winter.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a couple more. So you do public unions as well,
public and
disputes,
private, mostly public,
both
yes,
public and you mentioned something about the child care custody thing and child abuse. I'm wondering if you, when you get into mediation like this, are you a mandated reporter? If there were there something come out of a meeting with him behind closed doors, do you know that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, the law that we worked on was mediating between legislators and other members of the community, such as the bar and some of the judges. The judge that worked on this was Judge Peterson, one of the Hennepin County Family Court judges. Mm. We do not undertake mediation in family court, all right? And nor does the community mediation groups that we support. They're prohibited from doing divorce and child custody mediations, and they don't do those. This was a public policy mediation, but it was not a family mediation. Right. We're working on the law, not on the practicalities.
Right. Thank you. Yeah.
Sure.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I just want to go back to the, you went kind of fast over this, related to the family child care representation election. And you said, and I guess I can't remember, 59 for that, if it happens. And so has anything happened in that relation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no. We've had no petition by them.
So then would you think then the $59 million, that if it's not used or if there's no petition, then does that go right back to the taxpayers in other
Senator areas? Senator Scalzi, it's $59,000, not $59
million. That's right. I'm sorry. I meant $59,000.
Okay.
Right. Does that then go back into the general fund of all or just your general fund in your set in your department?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. That would roll back to the general fund if there's no petition that's filed.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of the commissioner? Okay, commissioner, do you have a couple people that want to make some comments? Or?
Yes, I'm going to invite the members of the Public Employment Relations Board to talk to you about their new board. They're in the process of starting up and explain to you what their situation is. So.
Okay, good idea. Okay, you can go in any order you want. Just say your name for the record and then just start your comments, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sandy Blazer. I'm the Chief Labor Relations Officer for the Metropolitan Council, and I am the Governor's appointee representing public employers on the new PERB. And I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Cooper. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I've been appointed as the alternate member on the board representing the interests of the public at large.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I am an attorney with Education Minnesota. I have been appointed to the Public Employment Relations Board to serve the interests of public employees.
Okay. Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, members, first of all, I want to thank you for and the legislature as a whole for the passage of this law and for the base funding that we were given for this current fiscal year of the $125,000. We began our journey here halfway through the fiscal year. So we were appointed late in 2014 and really didn't start meeting until 2015. So we're only just now beginning our work. We want to be sure that the funding that that our ability to carry out the mandate in the legislative action is funded so that we can do this in an effective and efficient manner. The law itself has a number of embedded costs into it beyond just the initial startup. As Tilson mentioned, our $125,000 base funding is to get us started as a small agency. We do have staff we have to hire. That is one of those embedded costs. We've been asked to retain the services of a general counsel. Part of the embedded cost there is that needs to be a licensed attorney. Our hearing officers who will actually hear cases are also required to be licensed attorneys. And so there's costs in terms of the staff that we hire in terms of their qualifications. One of the chief reasons behind the establishment of the PERB had to do with the cost of the existing unfair labor practice, which is really to file a charge in court. And so there's the retaining of attorneys, there's the court filing costs, there's a number of costs that make that practice costly. And so we're concerned about making this a process that employees, employers are able to use in a cost-efficient manner. And so we're concerned that the $125,000 in the base won't be sufficient. The governor's has requested an initial $200,000. We think that's the minimum. We do not believe we can do our work with less. We would be happy to do it with more, but we believe that that is the minimum that would allow us to carry out the legislative mandate in an effective and efficient manner. I know my colleague, Arbitrator Cooper, has done some research, a little bit of research in terms of what other, or we've had research presented to us in terms of what other states have looked at, and I'll let her comment about those things.
Ms. Cooper.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The legislature, I think, made very sound public policy decision in assigning the role of adjudication of unfair labor practices to an agency rather than requiring parties to go to court. The creation of the PERB should prove a cost-saving measure for public employers, including the state of Minnesota, municipalities, and school boards, as well as for public sector unions, because they don't have to incur those costs. While most states in the country have established an administrative agency for the adjudication of unfair labor practices, there is, as far as we know, no agency that has quite the scope and jurisdiction that ours has, and therefore it makes it very hard to determine how much business we might have. That is, how many unfair labor practice charges will be made in this first year. In many states, that number exceeds 100. In some states, it exceeds several hundred. Because this is a new process, we would imagine that both public sector employers and public sector unions would be inclined to file to get a sense of how the agency will be interpreting the statute and the definition of unfair labor practices. So it is very hard before we open to know what our caseload will be, how many hearings we will have, how many cases will have to be investigated. I would imagine that at this time next year, we would have a much better idea of what that will be. But frankly, we're very concerned because of the mandated costs that Ms. Blazer has mentioned, the things that the statute requires, that we need a budget that can cover those statutory mandates.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't need to add much more. My colleagues have done a wonderful job of explaining, you know, what it is we need to do and the money that we need to do it. I can echo what Ms. Cooper just said about this is a statutory change that should be applauded. We were one of three states that had unfair labor practices that did not have an administrative agency to handle those unfair labor practices. So out of the 35, we were one of three. And now we join the ranks of the 32 others that handle this in this manner. So we are asking that we get the budget that we can fulfill all of the statutory mandates that we have and proceed accordingly. Thank you for your time.
And so this is an attempt to make government more efficient and accountable. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
That sounds like a laudable goal. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. Just to get my hands around the, and maybe this is a commissioner question here with regards to recovering some of the expenses incurred. When you have a grievance, an arbitration award, or is there any inclusion in that or any revenue to offset the budget? In other words, if we're paying attorney fees on both sides, I assume there's going to be an agreement on a settlement. Does part of that settlement reimburse the state of Minnesota for your services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the answer is that the cost for labor arbitration, both grievances, which is a dispute over application of terms and conditions of employment, if there's a dispute over the way the contract was being adhered to or not,
or an interest arbitration, which is a dispute over a final negotiation of terms and conditions for essential employees, mostly public safety, fire, police, and some other employees. The costs for those are shared by the union and the employer. So to the extent that offsetting occurs, it offsets because the union is paying for half of it, the employer is paying for half of it. The state executive branch itself isn't paying for any of it except where they are the employer that's involved. Well, I shouldn't say. The Bureau has administrative costs, so I guess that's what the state's paying for. We administer the Bureau's, the state's arbitration roster. We administer a website that publishes the cases. So that's the state's share of the cost of labor arbitration, except for where they are actual party to the dispute.
Any Senator Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I got in there a little late in your presentation, but if you've covered this, just tell me. But the unfair labor practices, what can you go into a little more detail on what are all the types of scenarios you're going to be looking for? Is it all related to public and private union contracts? What other scope and breadth would you be involved with?
Hold on a second. Ms. Blazer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the unfair labor practices that we will be adjudicating are those that would be filed under statutory provision 179A...
.03.
We're all very familiar.
I'm sorry, .13. There's a number of them listed there. In addition, there is a new provision in the legislation that talks about concerted activity. These would be both primarily public sector as well as charitable hospitals, and could be filed by employers, employees, and or unions. Its potential is quite broad.
Ms.
Cooper, go ahead.
May I add, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, employees as individuals may file unfair labor practices as well. These would include things such as an allegation that a party in a collective bargaining negotiation was not bargaining in good faith. It might be an accusation that an employee had been discriminated against because of his or her union activities or concerted activities. Those would be the sorts of things that would be heard as unfair labor practices. And it's important to note that the board is not out looking for charges. It is only if an individual comes to the agency and files a charge that the agency would proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, two questions related to that. What happens if somebody files a frivolous case or has a baseless case but uses it as a bargaining tool to try to maybe put undue pressure on the other side for some other reason? Is there aspects of that that you would investigate as well? And then is there a penalty for somebody filing a baseless claim? Or what prevents that from happening?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the law has a standard by which we will be looking at cases, and the actual phrase is going to escape me. However, there is a standard. We will have a charge will be reviewed internally, and it will be looked at against the standard and dismissed if it does not meet the standard that was established in law. As no reasonable basis in law or fact, thank you, is the standard that is cited in the law. And so that will be the threshold that will be reviewed against as a charge comes in. If there is a basis in law or fact for the charge to proceed, then that will occur. To my knowledge, we do not have any kind of penalty for a frivolous charge, and we have only begun our discussions with regard to rulemaking, and that is not an issue that has been addressed.
So,
Ms. Blissenbach.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also wanted to add, if there is a hearing, the parties will be representing themselves in the hearing. So the cost to the agency is the cost of the hearing officer and the cost of a transcript. It's not the cost of attorneys to represent the parties. They will be paying for that on their own. And I should add, it's not necessary that attorneys, that the person representing the parties be an attorney. It could be a labor relations specialist. It could be anybody as designated by the parties.
So Mr. Chair, assumedly, it's likely more likely the employee or the labor union that's going to file the complaint. They may have a specialist that is familiar with these processes to help the person, but that person could also hire an attorney. If they did, that's going to be at their own expense. It's just you providing the adjudication, as you just said. The other side is likely going to be a business or an entity or an employer. They would likely have an attorney, would they not, as part of the process?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the labor relations community, it is fairly common for non-attorneys to represent the parties, both on the management side as well as on the union side, as the processes are often less formal than in the judicial process. So it's very common for non-attorneys to represent parties in labor arbitration or in negotiations, for example.
So from the instance of a government entity, which you said it would be, sounded like a good share of them, it could be a county or a city or state, somebody may not, what may not be an attorney, or it would be the county attorney or somebody, but what happens? What's the next process if they disagree with the outcome of your position? Does it go to the district court or appeal to the court of appeals? What's the next step?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the process will be an initial filing of a charge that if is meritorious, a hearing would be conducted. Exceptions to the results of those hearings would be heard by the PERB board itself. Exceptions to board recommendations would then be deferred to the district court.
Actually, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it actually is appeal.
The board's
decisions are appealable to the Court of Appeals.
You're right. Correct. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, last question. And let me just express some concern I would have. I always worry, and I deal with constituents that are, facing a state agency, and it's always a little the deck is stacked against them because the state gets a free attorney. My constituents' taxes pay that attorney, as well as they have to pay their own attorney, and some are guilty, some aren't guilty, but you still have to spend a lot of money to prove your innocence. And so I share that with you as an agency, that we are cognizant that it's a system set up fair and not. One of the things in the legal system that always makes people settle is the cost to their pocketbook. And when the state or a government entity has no cost, if you will, because the taxpayers will pay it, it's not the same as coming out of somebody's individual pocket or business checkbook. And so I share that with you. Will this affect our small businesses across Main Street, Twin Cities areas, and rural Minnesota? And if so, how?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the PERB board has no jurisdiction over any public sector employment, private sector employment relationships, except charitable hospitals that might fall under that statute. So the small business person would not have any relationship to the Public Employment Relations Board.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, is Erica Rivers here? Parks and Trails Division and the DNR. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, members, For the record, my name is Erica Rivers. I'm director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails.
How does this happen in your... I mean, we got Rivers, Parks and Trails.
To change our name.
Forest Bowen and DNR. I mean, how does you have to have a certain name in order to get these jobs, or what's the deal here?
Mr. Chair, I think it may be at this time that we're going to change names and have appropriately fit. A slightly more upbeat, perhaps, presentation than the last one you previously heard. I'm here today to talk about Minnesota State Parks and Trails, give you a little bit of an overview of our budget, as well as some of the change items that the governor has proposed in his budget this year. As many of you know, the Division of Parks and Trails is well-respected, well-regarded, very large system. We'll be celebrating our 125th anniversary in 2016. We are one of the oldest and most well-respected park systems within the nation. And our vision is to create unforgettable experiences that pass along a love for the outdoors to current and future generations. We do this by being really a cornerstone of Minnesota's tourism economy. We do this by playing host to about 8.7 million visitors every year and our 75 state parks and rec areas, 26 state trails, and 1,500 public water access sites. We're also blessed to have thousands of miles of motorized trails throughout the state of Minnesota. Those include motorized trails for snowmobiles as well as ATVs and OHVs. Rather than giving you more information about the breadth of our system, I've given you what we call our Parks 101 document. This should be in your packets. It was passed out last Wednesday when Assistant Commissioner Meyer was here. And they'll give you more information about the size and scope of the business that we run. We mostly manage the operations and maintenance of the state parks and trail system through six different accounts, the largest of which is this big piece of pie on the top there, the natural resource accounts. Those are dedicated accounts, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what they represent on the next slide. We also do a lot of our operations and maintenance through 20% of our funding from general fund, now about 22% through legacy fund, special revenue funds, as well as federal funds. Of this pie, it's important to point out that about 17% of the revenue that comes into the Department of Natural Resources goes directly out through grant and aid and competitive grants to local and regional parks and trails. I mentioned that net dedicated funding with the natural resources accounts. This really is made up of 11 different funds. We've condensed them down into six major funds here on this slide, the largest of which is the state park account, which is we get revenue from permits, camping, rentals, and tours. And that's that green piece of pie sort of on the left around between 9 and 11 o'clock. The snowmobile fund is the second largest dedicated revenue fund, about 24% of the natural resources fund. Water recreation would be the third largest account. That's mostly for boating and canoe routes as well as public water access sites throughout our state. We also draw revenue from ATVs. That's about 7% of this fund. And the Parks and Trails Lottery in lieu is about 11%. The other five accounts that aren't mentioned in specific slices here and captured under the other include the off-highway motorcycle, off-road vehicle, cross-country ski, horse pass, as well as a donation account.
What's included in the snowmobile account? Is it just...
The snowmobile account draws revenues from both unrefunded gas tax as well as registrations.
That's all. They're all in there.
I'm sorry?
That's all in there.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair, are there other questions about the revenue
source?
Does anybody have any questions about the revenue sources? Okay. No, go ahead. I was just making sure that was everything. I wasn't sure if it was just the registrations and the unrefunded gas tax or if it was...
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
The governor has proposed five change items related to parks and trails this year, three of which are from legacy accounts and one involving the state park operations, and the second, the snowmobile account. This first one that I have up here is a $9.5 million appropriation increase, both from fees as well as a general fund increase. This funding would be used for maintaining basic upkeep and rises in utilities costs for parks operations and maintenance. These include our real basic services in parks, including cleaning, security, and services. $3.6 million each year would be from the general fund, $1 million for the first year and $1.3 million the second year, from a very modest increase in our user fees. That would include a $1 increase per visitor for the daily permit and a $5 increase for an annual park permit. Without this increase, we anticipate we will need to reduce services at state parks by 154,000 hours next year, which would largely mean we would go to summer-only camping in all but five or six state parks.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, have you totaled the maintenance that has not been taken care of through the years? I know this is kind of an ongoing issue for us in Minnesota because we have so many state parks and we keep them in such good shape. Is there a figure that we have for unfunded maintenance?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we do have some figures that we have asked our acquisition and development coordinator to run through over the course of the last several months. I'm searching here. We provided a report about that to the House, and I can get you a copy of that as well. My recollection is that from both on the state parks, state water accesses, as well as state trails, the total unmet need at this point is about $57 million a year over the course of the next 25 years. So we tried to amortize out all the deferred maintenance over the course of the next 25 years, and that figure ends up being about $57 million a year to get everything up to speed within the course of that time frame.
And so you're asking this year for 9.5?
This would be $9.5 million strictly for operations and maintenance, Senator. This would not be for deferred maintenance. This would be to maintain a basic level of services throughout our system.
Thank you.
And so how much do these fee increases raise?
Mr. Chair, the fee increases are estimated to raise about $1 million the first year and $1.3 million the second year.
And you said it won't go to any deferred maintenance?
Mr. Chair, no. These would be for very basic operations and maintenance. This is cleaning the campgrounds, cleaning the buildings, making sure that we have people available to help campers, provide some security for overnight guests. Just the basic things that keep the lights on and keep our visitors satisfied with the system.
Mayor Westrom.
Chair, you mentioned you'd go down to eight or nine campgrounds remaining with camping after the summer season. Are you talking Memorial Day to Labor Day, basically, when you talk summer season? And how many parks right now have camping beyond the summer season?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, we estimate that we will go down to five or six campgrounds that will have long season operations. Right now, we have about 18 that we have cut to that level of the 75 state parks and recreation areas across the system. So it'll be a pretty significant decrease in the amount of camping. We estimate that this decrease without this general fund and fee increase, we would lose about 40,000 camper nights in the year, which would be a reduction in revenue in that natural resources revenue count for state parks by about $3.8 million. Over the course of the last two biennia, we have tried very hard to manage costs across the state park system, especially with regard to camping. We have trimmed around the edges as much as we can, made these reductions in camping at about 18 different units across the system. And we were able to manage those costs largely by only impacting about a little less than 1% of campers. There's just simply no more to cut. We can't cut around the edges anymore. And the next cut will be sort of cutting into bone at this point. We'll be reducing or losing revenue.
So two comments or questions. Those 40,000 nights, granted, aren't most of them aren't full or being used, and it's part of the reason you probably don't see the demand in that extended season. Secondly, have you, I believe you've used groups, sometimes friends of the ex-state park, you name it, Carlos State Park, Glacial Ridge State Park, that will come in and help take care of some of those services, maybe cleaning restrooms, keeping things picked up on a volunteer basis. Have you used some of those groups or tried to work with community partners, or what's the status of that to help cover some of these expenses that you talk about being to the bare bones?
Mr. Chair and Senator, thank you. Excellent question. Those 40,000 camper nights that we would lose are actual loss of nights. So we know that if we close these campgrounds in the off season, like for example, fall represents about 8% of our visitorship in camping. That those are actual losses. That's just not vacancies that will go unfilled. Those are actually lost revenue for us. In terms of the ability to use volunteers groups within the state parks, yes, we have tried to do that. We have a very extensive volunteer network throughout the system, in particular with campground hosts. And we rely on these campground hosts in particular in the lower use parks, those that will, in our new system plan, be considered rustic parks. These folks are extremely dedicated and really love these parks, and they've done what they can to help out. But there are basic staffing needs that exist in all these parks. It can't all be done by volunteers.
Last comment, Mr. Chair. The one comment on your nights, and I know there's always a delicate balance that's tried to be achieved, both in pricing, but there, my private resort owners, I certainly know, would do their best to cover those nights, and obviously appreciate the business as well. And so there's always a balance that we need to try to find. And so I'm sure they would be happy to try to help accommodate some of these camping nights.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Westrum asked my main question that I had, but in the discussion, another question popped up. So what you're saying then, Director Rivers, is that the off-season camping does not pay for itself right now, therefore that's the reason for the increase in the fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think that's exactly what I'm saying. In point of fact, I would like to just mention again some information I can submit to this committee as well. Most of Minnesota state parks don't make money. Only 18 of our units across the 75 actually break even, if you will, turn into the black when you look at revenues versus expenditures. State parks, in our view, and in the long 125-year history of outdoor recreation in the state of Minnesota, were intended to be a public good. And so, yes, we do support it with public monies over time to provide that public good for Minnesotans.
So let me follow up on that. So how much revenue do you lose when you have 40,000 camper nights not accounted for?
Mr. Chair, we estimate that will be a $3.8 million loss.
And doesn't that help you pay for your expenses if they are there?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
So why would you want to close them if you're going to get $3.8 million?
Mr. Chair, because we can't afford to run them.
It costs more than that to run them?
Yes, I believe so.
That seems like a lot to me. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea of closing state parks brings back some real unfond memories.
You were there, huh?
Yeah, I was there. We can argue all day how that happened, but the bottom line is it's very near and dear to folks. Can you tell me $1 a day? I think you said the fees were going to go for a dollar a day and $5 for a season. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. That's
and
correct.
What are they now? What is a daily fee? I visit it not real regular, but I'm not familiar with what a daily fee versus a year-round fee is.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the daily fee right now is $5. It would go to $6. The annual fee is $25. It would go to $30. We have done some social science research on the acceptability of those, this willingness to pay, and we have found that more than 90% of people who are currently visit our state parks are willing to pay those increases.
Yeah, I'm really, really confused now. So if we close for 40,000 nights and we lose $3.8 million, but we're only going to raise $2.3 by raising the fees, how do we come out ahead here?
Mr. Chair, we've also asked for a general fund increase of $3.6 million each year.
But it's the math still isn't working out here. It seems to me you're giving away $3.8 million by claiming you're going to close. And if you stay open, you got the $3.8
million. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I'm totally understanding your question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Westrom?
I think what you're asking, and maybe this will help, what is your cost of keeping those business, those 40,000 nights open? And if that's $7 million, your net loss is, well, $4 million or so. But by closing, you're saying you're going to lose $3.8 million, but you're also not going to incur that $4 million expense or whatever the number is. I think that's what you're looking for. What's the difference or what's the cost of keeping those 40,000 nights open?
Okay, understood. Mr. Chair and Senator, I'll have to get back to you on that to give you the exact numbers on how that all works out.
I would be very interested to hear it. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the concerns that I hear out there from my resort and campground folks is units that are built, camper units that are built in state parks. Can you give me a report as to how many there are now? And is that going to continue? Because obviously they're very nice. I get that. And I think even at one time you were using... and I might be taxing myself here to remember that you might have been using prisoner labor to make them at a pretty reasonable rate. However, there's a balance, as you say, with the private sector being concerned about those hard cabins. Can you tell me where they're at and what the status of those are statewide?
Ms. Rivers.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we have about 90 camper cabins within the state park system. We have said for quite some time that we would not be building more than 200 of those across the entire system. Right now, they rent at about between $45 and $60 a night. They are meant to be very entry-level accommodations for people who maybe aren't comfortable camping on the ground but need a little higher amenity. They are not in our view, in direct competition with the resort industry. We see them as a stepping stone to hopefully further tourism interests in greater Minnesota. We try to keep these very simple. As you said, many of them in the past were built with prison labor. They typically are fairly modest in their accommodations, usually just a couple of bunk beds and a table. You must cook outside, and there are no bathrooms associated with them. There are vault toilets associated with those units rather than bathrooms.
So we're going to continue then, Mr. Chair. We're going to continue until we hit the number of 200. Is that the plan?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we don't have immediate plans on building a whole lot more of these right now. We've had some struggles with the contract that we've had in the past to build these. So I'm not sure that we have a whole bunch of them planned right now.
Okay. So sure. Oh, Senator Rush.
On that related question, yurts, are they counted as a similar type cabin, or do you have yurts across the system? And if so, how many? And you're familiar with that, more of a tent-like permanent structure?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. We have 7 yurts that we're trying on a pilot basis, and we would consider those within that 200. They are an accommodation. They're meant to be a temporary structure. We don't have any immediate plans to build any more of the yurts either. We're just trying those out on a pilot basis at this point.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I slept in a yurt for my first time in the last year or two, and out of state, of course. I wasn't aware of them here, but I think they seem like a entry level, like you say, but very cost effective, I would think, for summer type camping.
I hope you'll have a chance to visit some of ours in the near future.
All right, thank you.
Give us a full report too when you do it.
Yeah.
So is the swinging bridge at Jake Cook State Park, is it still swing?
Mr. Chair, yes it is, happily.
Looks like it's got all kinds of pillars around it.
I'm sorry?
It looks like it's got all kinds of pillars around it.
Yes, it is actually still a swinging bridge.
Still swings on. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. Any progress as far as the feds are concerned with the flood damage down at Blue Mountain State Park with the dam reconstruction there?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I am happy to report that the that FEMA has given us preliminary approval to proceed with some design work on the dam reconstruction at Blue Mounds.
Is that just the lower dam or the or both of them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe it's just the lower dam. I can get you an update on that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One real quick question with regards to ATV trails. Just a real brief overview of that, if you could. I see how many miles we have, but has it been problems at all there, problematic, or are we looking at expanding? Because I know ATVs are expanding. Obviously, we don't have any snow. The snowmobile thing is kind of on hold, so that's always been an issue out there, I think, statewide.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for that question. The motorized trails are a big part of what we do. As you all are aware, that we had a phase one process where we designated many, I think, 12,000 miles of ATV trails within our state forests. That effort ended in about 2008. The biggest effort we're having and where we're focusing on our efforts now is to actually create integrated trail systems within our state forests. And we call this the phase two OHV planning process. We were able to accomplish some very nice connected trails within the Pine County forests this past biennium. And we're moving to northern Minnesota, north of the Iron Range, in the Taconite Trail area, Bear Island State Forest, near Tower Eveleth E, as our next phase two project. With the phase two project in the Pine City Forest, we were able to create an additional 138 miles of riding opportunity, which has been really exciting. Another area of focus that we'd like to have in the next biennium is to spend some time working with the off-road vehicle group to try to identify some touring trails for those that are riding in those four-wheel drive Jeeps and larger vehicles to try to find opportunities for them as well.
Okay, snowmobile trails.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second item that the governor is recommending is a $450,000 increase. That's $225,000 each year to the snowmobile account. This appropriation right now we're looking at as a one-time appropriation to try to meet some of the needs of the state trails, particularly with regard to increases of fleet and grooming. Without this, there will be less grooming and maintenance done on state snowmobile trails administered by the department. We've been working with MinUSA most recently just this weekend at their winter rendezvous to talk through this change item. My understanding is that they are bringing it to their board for a decision on their support or not to this change item yet this week and into March.
Based on their funding decline, they need some kind of a long-term solution. Is that what you're talking to them about?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is what we're talking about. We have a structural deficit in this account. It has existed for several years. My understanding is that the basis of this structural deficit actually occurs because we anticipated $3 million in trail pass revenue back some time ago, and the actual revenues that were coming in were closer to $2 million. Over time, we have brought down a balance in that account, which is originally about $8 million, and then had a very bad snow year in 2011-2012, which brought the account into the red. So we've been managing that deficit very carefully over the course of the last biennium to try to bring that balance in that account up to around $2 to $3 million so that we can sort of hedge the bets on bad snow years. And then, of course, we hit this year, and this year, in spite of what we see out the windows today, has not been a good snow year either. So this has impacts on the revenues to that account because fewer snowmobiles actually end up registering on this, the third year of the registration system. So we are anticipating lower revenues from registrations this year as well.
What's the balance in the account this year?
I'll have to get back to you on that, Mr. Chair. If there aren't other questions on this change item, Mr. Chair?
Are there any questions on the snowmobile? Go ahead.
The last three of the change items, I asked the chair if, for your guidance. They're all on legacy funds. I can go through just quickly about 5 seconds on each slide. I know that you'll probably have this referred to another committee.
Maybe you want to tie it back into the discussion of the parks that we had before and how the legacy money lines up with the money that we're talking about back in the parks and what you use it for and how it's different. And that might be a good discussion here, so I understand that.
Mr. Chair and members, the first change item related to, I should say, the governor's recommendations related to legacy funding in parks and trails are based on a 40-40-20 split. As some of you will recall, in 2011, there was quite a bit of conflict that existed between DNR, the Metropolitan Council, and Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails entities. We were asked by this committee and one in the House to actually come together as a group called the Dedicated Funding Working Group and come up with a solution so that there would be an easier time here within the, both bodies in deciding how to split up the money in the legacy account. So the governor is recommending continuation of the 40-40-20 agreement between the three entities, and we follow, within DNR, we follow the four pillars of the legacy advisory, or the legacy plan, the 25-year legacy plan in our distribution and decisions about where we will spend that money. In fiscal 16-17, we're recommending about 16% of that go to connecting people to the outdoors pillar, about 27% of it going to the acquiring land and creating new opportunities part of the pillar, and about 57% of it going to taking care of what we have. The second change item is the pass-through money that I mentioned earlier. This is $17.25 million that is recommended as that 20% going to Greater Minnesota. We're in the process right now of working with the Greater Minnesota Commission to try and get them to stand, to be independently managing their funds. But for this biennium, we recognize that they need some help in administering these grants, and so the department has put forward their change item for them, and we'll work over the course of the next biennium to help them establish criteria and make recommendations directly regarding this part of the funding. And then the final change item here is $1 million change item that we call an off-the-top appropriation. This was agreed upon by the three implementing agencies. Again, those are Metropolitan Council, DNR, and the Greater Minnesota Commission. And those funds would be used for doing a lot of coordination work. In previous biennium, many of you will remember that there were sort of apples to oranges comparisons between the systems and a great deal of a great deal of consternation that went back and forth about how many visitors were to each system, for example. This money would be used to provide for integrated web-based platform on which to make those apples-to-apples comparisons. We'd count visitors the same way. We would count trail miles the same way so that future funding decisions could be based on solid information. I think this is one of the best untold stories of what the Parks and Trails Legacy Account has frankly been able to do. It's been able to create a lot of different connections between different parks and trails implementing agencies to create a seamless system for Minnesotans and visitors to our state.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So the acquisition of 40 state park acres, can you talk about that, and or does that include 25 state trail acres? Are they one of the same? There's always a question about acquiring more land, and is the DNR actively looking to sell land that makes no more sense to actually belong? I know they have in a couple of different places sold an acre or two of state park adjacent properties, but the acquisition, can you talk about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. The 40 acres that we're proposing to use legacy money for in the next biennium are for a parcel on the west side of Jay Cook State Park. We believe that it's a critical parcel. It is within the state park boundaries, a critical parcel to provide recreational access to that west side of the park and connections of hiking paths that go through it.
25 state trails, same, that would be it? I mean, that's included in that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. That's the only acquisition we're planning in this legacy funding round.
All right. Any other comments or questions from Ms. Rivers? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair. No, wait.
Quick question on the camping fees.
Senator Westrom.
You said $25 annual fee. Is that per person, or what's a family pass? Or is it just however many kids times 25 or 30?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the $25 annual pass would be for a car. So it's a sticker that goes on your car, and however many people are in that car then get admission to the park for that fee.
I see. For the season. Okay.
Correct. For an entire year.
Oh, I see. So you bring a bus, a big van in. Huh? Thank you.
Very reasonable fee.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Bogus. While he's coming up, we have some girls that rock the Capitol here today. And why don't you all just stand up and tell us where you're from. They're apparently daughters of UCARE employees, and they're from all around the region. There's 80 of them touring today, and I guess 11 are here. So if you would just stand up and tell us your name and where you're from, we can get to meet you real quickly. So go ahead. Start right here.
I'm Trevor.
You're from where?
And I live in Hudson, Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
My name's Linnea, and I'm from Apple Valley.
Apple Valley. You're behind the screen. Come out from behind the screen.
I'm Michelle.
Well, welcome. I hope you're learning something today, because we learn something new every day, so I'm hoping you do too. So, thank you. Welcome. Pleasure to have you here. Okay, Mr. Vargas, go ahead.
Fish thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Shouldn't your name be Fish?
I don't know how I got the job, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. Our division manages wildlife management areas in the state as well as aquatic management areas. We have about 1.3 million acres of wildlife management areas and 930 miles or 45,000 acres of aquatic management areas. These are primarily the trout stream easements that people are familiar with, although we do have some lakeshore trout stream or lakeshore aquatic management areas as well. We manage fish and wildlife habitat for the fishable lakes in the state, as well as the 16,000 miles of fishable streams and rivers. There are over 61 wildlife and 28 sport fish game species that we manage fishing and hunting seasons for. And the license center is also in our division and manages the sales of 2.4 million licenses and 1.4 million registrations for boats, recreational vehicles, ATVs, snowmobiles, some of which you've already been hearing about. We manage the collection of the revenue for those registrations. Governor's recommendations for the biennial budget consist primarily of game and fish. We had a hearing in this committee a couple weeks ago to talk about the annual report that we do on the Game and Fish Fund. It is the primary fund that we use to manage our division. You will see that it's roughly 80% of the recommended budget. This budget does not include appropriations of Outdoor Heritage or Clean Water Fund that we also get outside of our base budgeting through competitive process. But just wanted to point out on this slide that the general fund that you see here, even though it represents 9% of the proposed budget, is for payment of treaty settlements for various bands where the state, through court action, has agreed to pay settlements. And so that's a open appropriation in the general fund that shows up in our budget, but does not contribute to the management of fish and wildlife by our division. Other sources of fund in there, there's a little bit of reinvest in Minnesota from the conservation license plates that you see on a lot of the vehicles around the state. Also other sources, natural resource fund, that I'll talk about a little bit more, and then various special accounts that we have. By and large, the Game and Fish Fund forms the foundation of our division's work and supports the activities of the division. We break those into five kind of strategic areas: fish and wildlife population monitoring and management is one of the primary functions that we do. This includes surveys of wildlife populations, monitoring those populations, setting hunting and fishing regulations for those populations. It also includes fish and wildlife health management, where we deal with diseases or potential diseases in fish and wildlife. Some of the most significant in recent years have been bovine tuberculosis, chronic wasting disease, and then preparing for viral hemorrhagic septicemia, which has been moving from east to west through the country. It's been found in the waters of Lake Superior, but so far, thankfully, not in the inland waters of Minnesota. Our second strategic, and so the population management is about 30% of our expenditures. Habitat protection, enhancement, and restoration. These expenditures do include money that we get from Outdoor Heritage and other sources. You can see that accounts for almost half of our total expenditures. This is for work not only on our wildlife management area and aquatic management area system, but also for work with partners. We do a lot of the implementation of habitat work through partnerships, grants, and technical assistance to other organizations and agencies that do habitat work. The third objective is the technical assistance, public participation, planning, and coordination piece. And this is a combination of both providing wildlife habitat and population information to other organizations and agencies, and also various ways of engaging the public in decision making and habitat projects. Fourth strategic area is outreach, recruitment, retention, and communication. Minnesota is one of the leading states in terms of participation in fishing and hunting, and our participation rates have stayed remarkably stable, but other states around the country have seen actually declines our total participation has stayed remarkably stable. Our participation rate as a percent of the population actually has been declining. We've gone from, for example, about 40% of people back in the 60s who lived in Minnesota fished. Now it's more like 28%. And hunting's gone from about 17% to about 10% of the statewide population. So our rates have declined. Our totals have stayed constant, whereas a lot of the states around the country, those total numbers have actually been declining. But we've put a lot of effort into trying to figure out ways to try to recruit particularly young people into hunting and fishing. It's mostly the 18 to 45 age group that's not participating at the same rate as their parents or grandparents did, and then also retaining people that are currently participating, and then the last objective is customer service. This is around license sales and other customer service that we do. Just quickly,
is that the stuff we got to call out of state for?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Is it customer service? Is that the out of state telephone agency that we have to call for?
Mr. Chair, our electronic licensing system contract. We do have 1,600 agents within the state, and we do have a license center within the state. But the vendor is located out of state, and that's where their call center is located.
And is there nobody in Minnesota that can do that, or
Mr. Chair,
it's bad enough we got to call India for our computers, but we got to call Tennessee for our
Mr. Chair, we have awarded that contract through a competitive bidding process. We're in the third round of those contracts right now. We certainly open it up to Minnesota vendors as well as other vendors, but we have not had a Minnesota vendor successfully compete for that contract to date.
Maybe we should make it a requirement. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this slide just shows within the Game and Fish Fund and the Natural Resource Fund a quick breakdown of what the sources. The Game and Fish Fund, as we talked about in a previous hearing, consists of a number of dedicated accounts. It's the primary revenue of this fund is from hunting and fishing license fees. The second most important source of revenue to this fund is the reimbursements from the Pittman Robertson Dingell Johnson programs, which are federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. And then the third biggest source of revenue is the heritage, what's called the heritage enhancement account on this graph, which is the lottery in lieu of sales tax. A portion of that gets deposited into a heritage enhancement account, which is an account within the Game and Fish Fund. We get a little bit, relatively small amount of natural resource fund in our division. Most of that's from the water recreation account and goes for aquatic plant management and then also a portion of our license center. You can see also some snowmobile ATV and other account money that goes into managing the license center, which issues those registrations and titles.
Do you overlap with Parks and Trails on snowmobiles?
Mr. Chair, we collect the revenue from the snowmobile registrations. We don't expend the dollars other than just the amount that's needed for license center to run that registration program.
So none of this goes into trails. This is just a total administrative.
Mr. Chair, this just goes into the license center to collect those registrations.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bogus, what percentage of the pie there is the Pittman Roberts? Or am I missing that? Is that other?
Chair and Senator Ingebretson, the Pittman Robertson does not show as a separate slice here because it's a reimbursement of state. We first have to expend state dollars, and then we get a 75% reimbursement on that, and that just goes into the Game and Fish Fund. So it would be part of the operations piece there, and I'm trying to recall the percentage. It's about, so these are biennial numbers. It's about $30 million a year for the Pittman Robertson and the Dingell Johnson. So about $60 million, roughly, of that $130 million would be from those reimbursements.
So, Mr. Chair, can you give us an idea? I mean, it's not a secret that it's, you know, the gun sales and the ammunition sales. I mean, some calibers you can't even get your hands on of ammunition in the state of Minnesota and probably other states as well. But that's a real reflection of some of the revenues coming in here. That's a good thing, I guess. But can you tell me how much that's increased over the last five, six years?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, the Pittman Robertson side of that equation, which is the wildlife restoration side, had been on a general increase over the past decade, but it increased dramatically starting about 4 or 5 years ago, where we went from about $11 million to 15 point some, almost $16 million to the federal fiscal year 14, it was $23 million. Federal fiscal year 15, it's anticipated to be around $23 or $24 million. So it's up over $10 million a year from what it was 4 or 5 years ago. We don't anticipate that that's going to continue at that level, that it's likely it's going to drop back to a more normal level at some point, and in fact it could drop below normal at some point just because there's been a lot of ammunition and a lot of firearms purchased. There's You know, most people think it's due to concerns about potential gun regulation. But there's also no doubt there's been an increase in shooting sports and interest in shooting sports. So it's something that you'll see when I get into the initiatives. We aren't banking on long term. We have some one-time proposals, but we don't want to put a lot of investment into staff and have long-term tails that might be relying on revenue that's not going to continue into the future. So it's been a significant increase. We're not sure how long it will stay at those levels, but it has contributed significantly to the balance of the Game and Fish Fund and the projected balance.
Thank you. Just one follow-up question. So with regards to retention of hunters, obviously the shooting sports thing has certainly gotten to be a big thing in Minnesota. Some bills floating around about expanding in that area. Is the DNR supportive of that? If so, there'll always be the big question of whether we should do public ownership or private ownership, because I think most gun clubs now are private. What's the DNR?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we are supportive of putting more investment into those shooting facilities. I know a couple of the bills I think you're referencing that are introduced this year. I guess we haven't taken a position yet on that magnitude, but last year legislature appropriated $2.16 million for grants to public ranges, they're grants to ranges that are open to public shooting. They're grants. The ranges themselves are private ranges, but we're in the process of issuing those grants. We did an expedited round and got about 40 of those grants out, around $400,000, and we've recently opened the larger grants that are open to larger projects, and those funds, that 2.16 is available till the end of the fiscal year 17 or the next biennium. And in terms of what the capacity is to issue those types of grants to private ranges in the state, we have over 300 ranges in the state, so it's maybe a little early to know what the capacity is to do those kinds of grants, because one of the conditions is that if they're recipients of those grants, that they are open to the public, at reasonable hours and that sort of thing. So I guess we'll need to have more discussion about the specifics, but in terms of the conceptually, yes, we're supportive of putting more investments into those types of opportunities. That's one of the things that we've seen. And you'll see in our governor's initiative, we have a small shooting range initiative from the department that's intended to go beyond the trap shooting, which has been the focus of last year's bill and a couple of the bills I've seen this year. So moving into the initiatives, we've got a broad fish and wildlife enhancement and reinvestment initiative that has various subcomponents that I just want to take a few minutes to talk about. Of this roughly $10.5 million biennial initiative, or about $5 million a year, It does help to leverage some of those Pittman-Robertson wildlife restoration dollars that we talked about before. Those have increased to a point that that's becoming more and more difficult for us to do those state expenditures up front that are required to get that 75% reimbursement. So by increasing eligible expenditures, we can capture more of that federal revenue. Hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching in Minnesota generate over $3 billion in retail expenditures annually. They're a major economic driver, particularly in rural parts of Minnesota. The first portion of this initiative actually deals with fisheries management and monitoring. our per capita fishing in Minnesota is second only to Alaska. It's a very popular activity, as all of you on this committee, I'm sure, know. And fishing alone is $2.4 billion in annual expenditures in Minnesota. But to maintain that, we need to make sure that we're collecting the good information that we need to manage those fisheries. This initiative would add creel survey capacity to evaluate harvests by anglers on more than just the major large lakes in the state where we're doing it now. It would also provide enhanced survey work for doing fishery surveys on those lakes and rivers. It would enhance aquatic habitat management capabilities and would allow us to continue the long-term monitoring of what we're calling sentinel lakes. These are important lakes throughout the state, throughout all parts of the state, that allow us to monitor changes in those lakes due to land use or climate change or other changing factors. You may have heard about the Tuolumne lakes in the state. That's part of that program, where Tuolumne are very sensitive to water temperature and oxygen and very easily can be extirpated from lakes if the lakes are degraded through land use change or temperature change.
Mr. Boggison, are those expenditures all eligible for Pittman-Roberts?
Mr. Chair, the fisheries expenditures would be Dingell-Johnson or the fisheries restoration. Apportionments, federal apportionments, have stayed relatively stable, and we currently have no problem capturing our full federal apportionment, so we're not leveraging any additional dollars with the fisheries expenditures.
Okay, I thought I heard you say, though, that if we had to increase our expenditures in order to get all our Pittman-Roberts money.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's there's like five pieces to this initiative. It's a very large initiative, and the pieces that relate to wildlife will leverage those dollars. The pieces that relate to fisheries will not.
And is it necessary to increase our expenditures, or would we just do it just to get the extra federal money?
Mr. Chair, we believe these are things that we need to do to invest in the conservation of fish and wildlife in the state.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Boggess, just the Tuolumne question brought a fourth question in my mind. The DNR manages 5,400 fishing lakes and 16,000 miles of fishable streams and rivers. So I'm assuming that all of these lakes and rivers and streams are fishable, so they're very healthy, fairly healthy, put it that way. If your budget is $240 million for fish and wildlife, would you say that your water, fishable water portion of that budget is what, a half or two-thirds? Or is there a way you can define how much of your budget goes to keeping fishable lakes and streams and rivers versus wildlife habitat?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I can't tell you right off the top of my head. I can say there's been an issue. It's been characterized as an imbalance issue between the revenues from hunting licenses and Pittman-Robertson versus revenues from fishing licenses and Dingell-Johnson. And currently we're spending more on fisheries than we're bringing in with fishing-related revenue. And we also have within our division, you know, smaller efforts around outreach and recruitment and retention that kind of cross. So, but our fisheries section budget is bigger than our wildlife section budget currently. But I don't have the exact number. I could get back to you on that.
That would be helpful. Thanks.
The next piece of this initiative, Mr. Chair, deals with angler and hunter recruitment and retention. The commissioner did a citizens council on hunting and angling recruitment and retention. They came out with a number of recommendations, so we have a modest amount proposed in here to help to do a recruitment and retention academy to help organizations and groups that are interested in this recruitment retention issue. And there are a number of our NGO partners out there that have been working on this issue. The goal of this academy would be to help facilitate these organizations to help develop youth after school activities related to hunting and fishing. increased angler hunter marketing campaigns targeted at adults, which some of the national efforts are indicating adults may be more prone to actually continue, at least in the near term, in these activities once they learn how to deliver more skills-based programs on learn to fish and hunt, to provide family-oriented hunting and fishing events, and to create a web-based recruitment and retention clearinghouse. The third component of this would accelerate management of our public hunting and fishing facilities, particularly wildlife management areas, would improve the facilities, site cleanup, maintenance, and access to public hunting lands in the state. We are getting a lot of the habitat work done through Outdoor Heritage and other sources, but that money has not been available for facilities and access, so this would help to provide better access and also better information about those areas. Would allow us to complete our conservation easement baseline reports and ongoing monitoring for easements, to do WMA and AMA system plans and individual unit plans, and to maintain our wildlife and aquatic habitat management application enterprise information system that we've developed with some Environment Natural Resource Trust dollars, but will require some ongoing management and maintenance. The next portion of this deals with population and habitat management, would enhance implementation of the Prairie Plan, which we've been doing for the last 4 years or so through helping to bolster the local technical teams. These plans are working with willing landowners and with other agencies and organizations, and this would help us to improve the delivery of those programs by better organizing those local technical teams to provide that assistance to landowners. Would it also include forest and brushland habitat management for moose, grouse, fisher, pine marten, and other forest-dependent wildlife, where we've been less successful at getting the outdoor heritage funds for forest habitat projects. Would allow expanded research on contaminants and upland birds, prairie chickens, spruce and sharp-tailed grouse, waterfowl, pheasants, fur bears, bears, wolves, squirrels, elk, deer, moose, and shallow lake habitats. There's some one-time money for refining our moose survey methodology. The moose population, as I think the committee knows, has been in decline the past 10 years or so. We've switched to a helicopter stratified survey about 10 years ago. We'd like to refine that survey with some one-time expenditures. We'd also like to continue to do annual wolf population surveys and recalibrate our deer models more frequently. There's a lot of concern recently about deer densities, and we, in parts of the state, can recalibrate our models using aerial surveys. We could do it more frequently if this initiative is funded. So that's the first major initiative that broadly covers all the programs in the division. The second one is $1 million over the biennium shooting range and recreational shooting initiative. This would go beyond the trap shooting that the $2.16 million last year was targeted at, and would particularly target archery. We have Minnesota is a participant in the National Archery in the Schools program. Archery has been very popular. It's been in a lot of the popular movies for young people in recent years, and we've got archery in the schools in nearly 400 Minnesota schools right now, and have reached about 180,000 students with that program. So, but we need more archery shooting opportunities. They're generally pretty easy to site and build and relatively cheap. We'd also like to expand opportunities for other types of shooting sports besides trap shooting, whether it's sight-in ranges for rifle, We'd like to find more opportunities for unstaffed ranges on public lands, state or county lands, where we could do sight-in ranges. Those tend to be very popular, and if they're not staffed, could be managed long-term with a little investment. This would provide technical and programmatic support to expand those ranges, and would also create increased access to shooting and sight-in opportunities for people taking firearm safety or that just need a place to go shoot. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, those are our two initiatives.
So, Mr. Bogus, you mentioned the deer and the moose, and I know there was a big meeting up on the North Shore about deer and the lack thereof, and wolves kept coming up. And I don't really want to open anything up here about wolves, but can the DNR appeal the judge's decision to not allow the wolf hunting season anymore? Because it seems to me that wolves are involved in moose also. So what can you tell me about that?
Mr. Chair, wolves have been a significant source of mortality with moose as well. And there was a recent December D.C. District Court decision that put wolves back on the list. Minnesota was an amicus intervener in that. There have been appeals filed now by the Fish and Wildlife Service and by that was just on Friday of last week that was announced, and then by at least one of the sportsmen's coalitions. There are other parties to the lawsuit that may also now join in that. They're full parties, and so we are an amicus intervener in that, and we would plan to file another brief at the D.C. Court of Appeals on that. It is obviously an issue where the state's limited in its abilities to influence that. It's been wolves have been delisted by federal rule in Minnesota several different times in the last 10 years, and each time that rule has been overturned by a court challenge. So we're hopeful this will succeed, but frankly, the track record has not been very good in the federal courts with trying to remove wolves.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Bogus? Okay. Oops,
real quickly, retention of youth. How about retention of old guys and gals? Anything going on there? I mean, are the numbers dropping there at the 60 plus, or
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's actually something that we've been looking at, and one of the things that we see, particularly with in the hunting side with archery hunting, is that there tends to be a drop off starting in like people in their mid 50s. And last year, the legislature did allow crossbow use for people 60 and over, which we do consider to be a retention type regulation, because two reasons. One is that people that maybe were doing traditional archery, but were for whatever reason, maybe not as able to pull back a standard bow, could continue with a crossbow. And then also, we suspect that a lot of people that are deer hunters but have not been archery deer hunters, maybe it was more just the learning curve, whereas with a crossbow, it shoots very much like a gun. And we think a lot of traditional firearms deer hunters may be more interested in hunting maybe when it's a little milder, maybe when there's fewer people out there. So that's one of the key issues, but it is a very valid point, because we are seeing a drop-off, and that was one of the earliest ones that we were seeing was in the archery hunting. So it'll be interesting to see. We don't have a special license for that. It'll be difficult to track exactly, but it'll be interesting to see how that translates over the years.
To that point, as long as you got two women in the pictures, how many female hunters do we have?
Mr. Chair, the number has been increasing. I can't recall the number off the top of my head. I can get back to you on that.
You got a percentage idea?
A percentage? For deer hunters, I would say it's in the 15 to 20% range.
Those two are pheasant hunters, I think.
Yeah, I think those are grouse hunters, grouse? Mr. Chair, okay. And I'm not on small game hunters. I'd have to get back to you. It's okay. Probably in the 10% range.
All right. There, Senator Scalzi, you can start hunting. No. No? You do or don't?
Am I what?
Do you hunt? Do you hunt?
I have a question.
Do you hunt?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, there. There's one of them.
That's
okay.
Only grouse, though.
Grouse? Right. Okay, good. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
That's on the record.
Rodman. Enforcement Division. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes before we're going to finish this. So if we don't get through this, we'll continue it at the next meeting, okay? Go ahead.
For the record,
welcome to the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. And I will go fast. Mr. Chair, just for some basis, the Division of Enforcement is basically a service delivery division within the Department of Natural Resources. We don't build bridges, buy land, maintain land, or do any type of management. Our funding basically goes towards the compensation for putting people in the field and the expenses that go with putting those people in the field. So we employ currently 185 conservation officers, and that number is down, which I can get to in one of our change items here in a little bit. Annually, we certify about 36,000 youths in safety education programs, working through 4,400 volunteer instructors throughout the state. We recently tracked over a period of a couple years how many outreach opportunities our officers are engaged with, and outside of firearm safety classes and whatnot, we average about 1,300 individual opportunities where our officers will get up in front of groups of people and connect with them, whether it's rotary clubs or sportsmen's clubs or whatnot. So we do a lot of outreach. And lastly, we do administer about 300 grants, pass-through money, either state money or some federal Coast Guard money, to mostly local law enforcement through sheriff's offices. But we also have an excellent program. It's a model in the nation called Trail Ambassador Program for local ATV clubs to do some monitoring of ATV trails. So about 300 state and federal grants to partners. Our budget is fairly straightforward and simple, and it's basically how we do our work plan. Overwhelming majority of it is game and fish fund, and that's where we go out and check licenses and bag limits on either the game or fish side of things. The natural resource fund, that's about 23% of our overall budget, those are from the variant accounts, the snowmobile account, ATV account, off-highway motorcycle account, water rec account, that make up those natural resource funds. Those are some of the biggest ones. I think I have a slide after that. And then we do have about 10% of our budget comes from the general fund. And of that 10%, about half of that is our dollars that have rider language for aquatic invasive species. But of the general fund, those dollars are some of the public safety and search and rescue stuff that we do help other agencies do. Of the game and fish operations, you can see last biennium that 93% of our game and fish fund is from the game and fish operations. We do receive about $3 million biennially from the heritage enhancement or the lottery and lieu money. And then we get a small portion of money that is actually housed in the game and fish fund, but it's not really game and fish money. It's there's a surcharge in every citation that any officer in the state writes that goes towards a peace officer training account for conservation officers, and that just happens to be housed in the Game and Fish Fund. And the Natural Resources Fund, as I mentioned earlier, some of the accounts where we get our money is majority of that is the Water Rec account. We do get some money from the Snowmobile account, ATV account, and then there's a couple other smaller accounts, off-road vehicle, off-highway motorcycle accounts where we get some money from the Natural Resource Fund. We have three change items.
So are those always a fee on their licenses? Is that how you get your money?
Mr. Chair, are you talking about the accounts for the Natural Resource Fund?
You're right.
Mr. Chair, we do get in a portion of the ATV account, for example, and those dollars, just like the snowmobile account, come from user registration and unrefunded gas tax.
Okay.
We do have three change items this year. The first one is a investment natural resource law enforcement. We currently have about 24 vacancies, field vacancies to deliver service, at 29 vacancies overall, including some supervisor managerial. And the first change item here is to provide funding to refill about 11 of those 24 field vacancies over the biennium.
Is that what the $2.5 million pays for? Or is it?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
The second change item that is being proposed or sought is a change item and this is kind of tied with the deficiency bill funding that was heard in Senate finance here, and which status is kind of unknown at this time. But the change item here is there was a increase in the employer paid portion of retirement, and we were just seeking to get that. So depending on what happens with the deficiency bill, these numbers may change as we move forward. The last change item that's being offered is some of our aviation right sizing. So the Division of Enforcement is the aviation portion of the Department of Natural Resources. We currently have six fixed wing and three helicopters, flyable helicopters, and two non-flyers. And how we got into the rotary or helicopter business was back in the 90s, the military gave us two surplus helicopters that flew and two that didn't fly. And we basically started a rotary aviation program through those gifts from the military, and those are Bell OH-58s. And as you can see, the two that are still flying, one's a 1968 and one's a 1972. They'd probably have collector plates if they were cars. they're getting very expensive to maintain. And right now we're to a point where the blades are timing out and you cannot find replacement blades for them. So what we're looking to do here is to do some right sizing. Give back. We have to give back. We cannot sell these military surplus aircraft. Give those back to the military. And instead of getting two new ones, we're looking at ways for efficiencies. So we would just need to have one replacement to get those. And then and our fixed wing assets, as I said, we have six fixed wing aircraft, and we do have a 1985 Cessna that has extremely high hours on it that is up for some type of replacement here in the next couple years. So that's what that change item is there.
The $2.5 million is it all necessary? I mean, can about $1 million comes from the general fund? Can you get it all from the game and fish fund?
Mr. Chair, can't answer that question.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, any questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. Lori, can you do this in 5 minutes? Or six?
Mr. Chairman, Lori Martinson, Director of Operations Services Division for the DNR. I'd be happy to try and get this done in 5 minutes. And as an avid hunter and fisher person, so here we go. The operations support includes the Division of Operations Services, which I'm the director of. It also includes the Commissioner's Office and Regional Operations.
First question is, where did the solar panels come from? Where did the solar panels come from in the picture?
Mr. Chairman, at this park, I cannot recall exactly where these panels came from.
Good answer.
Not from out of state, I hope.
As a quick overview of the budget, the overall operating budget over the biennium for 16-17 is $168.7 million. Of that is mostly internal billing, special revenue, and I can go into that more on the next page and do a breakout for you. I think that will be most helpful. So of the internal operations billing, a great portion of it is for fleet and facilities, asset management, $50.7 million. Another portion is for facility direct costs. That's $6.9 million. That includes lease, the rent on leased facilities, and it also includes things like heating oil, the fuel, electricity, and connectivity bills at some of our co-located facilities. We also have professional services, and that includes engineering services and some grant management services that we provide for the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Environmental Trust Fund. We have another category called Other. It includes a broad range of things, including the money we get from the Conservation Volunteer, FEMA grants, when the legislature makes a direct appropriation for natural resource disasters. If we have general fund in there, it would show up in here. We also have $25.2 million for IT services. We collect that money internally within the agency and then pay for our IT bill out of here. And then operations support, which includes things like HR, our finance, shop, fleet, safety, administration, what am I missing, planning, and communications. We have three budget items. I'm going to go over the first budget item, and then our CFO is going to go over the last two. We are asking for $1 million each biennium for a citizen engagement in natural resources. So our current DNR website was built back in the 80s, and we are proposing to move to a more current web platform and also to have an integrated platform so that we can better meet the needs of Minnesota citizens. We have two goals here. One is to make our information more readily accessible to citizens, and then secondly, to be able to better engage citizens, to have them also provide input back into the agency. We spent a couple years actually working on this proposal internally, and we feel like this is a really solid proposal that will allow us to move forward in an incremental and steady fashion, and this is the right amount of funding for that. Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Barb Julick, DNR. The next change item is a one-time funding request for $1 million for the biennium. Funding here would go toward supporting our legal support costs of the agency. In the last few years, we have seen rise in this area, needing, and we project that that will continue through the next biennium as we defend decisions on water management, environment, and other issues. Without this funding, the added cost would come from program areas' budgets, and so we are requesting a one-time funding for the next biennium here. And the last one, very quickly, the governor is recommending an operational adjustment for all state agencies. This is reflecting the DNR's request. It is based on a 1.8% adjustment to compensation projections for fiscal year 16 and 17. It is only requested on direct appropriated funds, so not the statutory appropriated funds, and only in those funding sources that have a fund balance to draw from, if you will. And so this includes a general fund request. It includes game and fish operations only. No other game and fish accounts are would be included in here. Under natural resources, it includes mineral management, snowmobile, water rec, ATV, off-highway motor vehicle, and off-highway to ATV ones. And again, that's a 1.8% increase per year.
On the website thing, what's going on now that you're not doing that you need to do? Or, you know, I always worry about if we get the latest and greatest technology, that the people that need to use it don't have the oldest and worst technology, mm-hmm. and they can't access your latest and greatest technology. So are we going to be putting people out of use, or are we going to be getting people into a spot where they can use it better?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to be putting people into a spot where they can use it better. Our current website, it takes us a lot of work to be able to create an integrated web page. Last year we created a phishing web page, which brought together a lot of data and made it easier for citizens to be able to access information not only about fishing licensing regulations, but also where to fish, the lake maps, brought it all together in one application. Developing those applications in our current platform is really difficult. And it also is not easily accessible by all different kinds of devices. And so I wish our CIO was here to help answer a little bit more in depth, but It's a pretty simple approach that would get us onto a new platform, make our content, work on getting our content current and refreshed, and then be able to integrate that so that we can provide better resources.
And is a million enough?
Mr. Chairman, we believe that a million is enough.
Senator Westrom, I just saw a report on the MNLAR system and from NDOT, and $43 million wasn't enough, and so I'm just wondering if a million is enough. So, anyway, well, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned a million more for lawyers. Can you elaborate on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so we are requesting $500,000 a year for the upcoming biennium only. We anticipate, as we look to defend decisions in environment or water management activities, that we would have a need to increase our legal support. This includes two full-time in-house attorneys, potential additional legal services either from the Attorney General office or other outside assistance to help defend those decisions. And again, we typically budget around $835,000. In the last few years, it has exceeded that quite a bit, so this would continue that.
Well, Mr. Chair, did you say two more lawyers?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So quarter million apiece gets you a lawyer?
No, Mr. Chair, this includes not only the two additional full-time positions, but it would include additional support either from the Attorney General office or outside support, plus other costs that typically go with defending decisions, including expert witnesses.
So Mr. Chair, fees. Mr. Chair, I discussed this earlier at the first presentation today, but let me just ask you the question. That's not quite 100% increase, but just about. If you're spending $800,000 now and you want $500,000 more, are you maybe contesting or fighting the private landowners or the constituents we represent more than you need to? And it reminds me of a lake drainage situation with farmers out in central Minnesota, Hutchinson-Glencoe area, that's ringing a bell, and I remember reading and hearing about that scenario last fall, and they're fighting the DNR to just be able to use their land. Is that the type of litigation we're going to be funding? Just seems like a lot more money, and here again, the taxpayers pay your attorney's fees. The other side that you're fighting is using their own money. Any comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this is Lori Martinson. Just based in the last year, we have ongoing costs of around $835,000. Last year, we saw a $450,000 increase to that just for White Bear Lake and Lynn Rogers. So sometimes these bigger lawsuits that are not us pursuing action but somebody outside coming and pursuing some action end up being quite costly, and then those dollars come out of the programs which are, you know, so came out of Fish and Wildlife, or the White Bear Lake came out of the waters accounts.
And last point, Mr. Chair, we've got an Attorney General's office with, I don't know, somewhere between 100 and 200 attorneys. How many of them are you using?
Mr. Chairman, we reach an agreement every year, and we spend, our current agreement is for $835,000, and I'm not sure of exactly how many attorneys that is.
We'll get that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we'll get that.
Thank you. All right. Meeting adjourned.